Visiting with you again, hoping that your life is going well and that you are doing what you want to do. If you're not, stop. I did a motivation course one time, and the guy said, if what you're doing isn't working, stop it and start doing something else. And I thought, God, what a great thought, you know, and I've kind of kept that in my mind. And speaking of motivational courses, here's a man who I'm sure has probably taught some, listened to some, and been around. I've been talking with this fellow now for the last couple of weeks, and his life is, well, it's much more interesting than a lot of ours. Mike, I'm going to let you pronounce your last name, sir.
Okay, it is DeZino.
D-E-Z-I-N-O?
Two N's, Bill.
D-E-Z-I-N-N-O. DeZino, Mike DeZino. Now, that's, I wonder what extraction that is. Is that Indian? What is that?
No, it's Italian.
Italian?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Italian. Well, that explains a lot of things. I didn't realize you were Italian. Mike, welcome to Blind Like Me. Sure, it's good to visit with you. Where are you located? What's your?
We're in South Carolina right now. We're originally from the Northeast.
Northeast is in New England?
Yep, Connecticut, actually.
So this cool weather doesn't bother you one bit, does it?
No, it just makes me glad I moved south. Just a little reminder.
Just a little reminder. Yeah, it is a little cooler. I mean, a little warmer here than it would be in, say, Bangor, Maine or someplace like that.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
And you are, I think we discussed, you're in your 50s?
I'm 57, actually, so I was born in 49.
So you've done a good bit of living in 57 years, haven't you?
Yeah, Phil.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all have, haven't we?
I guess we have, whether you like it or not, we have.
As long as you keep eating and breathing, you'll make it.
That's what I hear. I think that's a good thought. Now, let's get back to your younger days when you were a child. Where did you grow up, and how did you grow up? And tell us about your formative years, sir.
Okay, great. First of all, though, Phil, I want to thank you for the privilege of being a guest here on your Blind Like Me show and all. You guys doing some great work there. I've been catching some of the archive shows, and I do appreciate the work you're doing, and just my hat's off to you and the other folks who put this together. I was born in Waterbury, Connecticut, which was an industrial town, and I was born legally blind.
Okay.
I had 2200 in my best eye and 2800 in my worst eye, and it was non-correctable.
Okay.
I had no central vision. It was all peripheral, and it was almost, it was closing down the tunnel vision at that point. And basically, I could see large shapes, and if the color was bright enough and a big enough piece of it, I could tell you a color.
Okay.
And I didn't realize it till I was in kindergarten. That was the first eye test. They just thought up until then I was one of them clumsy kids. If you threw something to him, he wasn't going to catch it. And they weren't even sure that I wasn't. Actually, there was even some discussion I might have been mentally retarded. They weren't sure in those days. And what really helped things out was that this eye test I had in kindergarten, which was pretty interesting, because, you know, by the time they set me up there and said, look at the chart on the wall, and I'm wondering where the wall is. And that kind of kicked things into high gear, because what happened was the state of Connecticut immediately came to my mother and said, there's no way he's going to public school.
Yep.
Being blind, because back in those days, they packed folks like you and I up and found a well-meaning bunch of people who ran a blind school and said, well, we'll educate him here. Well, that wasn't going to sit too well with my mom. My mom was in the underground during the Second World War for 6 years.
Really?
Yeah, and she had spent 6 years of her life, risking her life, fighting the fascist governments over in Europe, be it, she was in Italy, so she was fighting Mussolini and Hitler, and the communists, too, over there, that they could come in and bust your family up, take your kid away, put them in a youth group. To her, that's what was happening here.
Whatever they wanted to do, yeah.
Yeah, and she just got really upset by that. And she just thought it was like the irony of ironies that she spent 6 years risking her life, comes to the freest country in the world, and they're telling her they're taking her kid away. That's how she saw it. So she put up a big stink. She barely spoke English in those days. She spoke seven languages. English eventually was her seventh, and she was learning it, teaching it to herself. And what had happened was I was born in Connecticut, and that became a lucky thing because of the Korean War. Being born in 49, and now I'm entering public school in 55, the Connecticut and California had veterans hospitals. And during the Korean War, there were more guys blinded than in World War II because of the change in the munitions. So the Connecticut had the beginning of a blind program, though it was for adults.
Okay.
So it was time that it had one for kids. And my mother fought the necessary battles, got our congressman involved, had an Italian congressman that year just elected, so it all worked out so she could communicate with him.
Yeah.
In September of 56, when I started public school, from what I understand, I was the first blind child in the United States that went through public school from kindergarten right through high school. And that was the beginning of what I was told what became the United States mainstream program for all children of special needs.
Okay, so you never went to a blind school, you went to public school the entire time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And my mother felt that I needed to face the world as it really was. My dad abandoned us. Here's my mother, an immigrant, barely able to speak the language. We're living in an inner-city housing project. She's holding down minimum-wage jobs just to make ends meet. And she just pushed me out the door and said, the world is out there, and you're going to have to meet it on its terms because it's not going to change what it does for you.
Yeah. Well, she's very on target.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. So public school all the way in what you said, Waterbury, did you?
Waterbury, Connecticut, yeah.
And that's a reasonably, at that time, was a fairly small community, right?
No, actually it was one of the five largest cities in Connecticut. It was about 120,000 people, 180,000 people. It was an industrial center. During World War II, it was a priority one target because of all the brass and copper manufacturing. Up until the end of the Second World War, if you went anywhere in the world and found something with a clock gear or a belt buckle or a brass button, it was made in Waterbury, Connecticut.
Okay, but you had no contact with any other blind children of it at all?
No, none. That was interesting because I had to go out into the projects and, you know, and try to fit in with the kids and learn how to play marbles and learn how to play baseball cards when I had to hand the card to somebody and say, now, who am I flipping down there? Read that to me.
Yeah, and
you know how many Mickey Mantles I lost because they lied to me.
I'm sure I would imagine they did. And so you were in the projects, you were going to school, and no other blind children around, just you and your mom against the world.
Yeah,
man, that's kind of a tough childhood, sort of.
I don't perceive it as being tough because they didn't have anything to compare it against. You know, they lock you in a room alone and say, who's taller? Well, you got no answer for that question. So that's pretty much what happened to me. I was just isolated to the point where I didn't see the uniqueness of my situation. It just was the way it was. And my mother pretty much pushed me out the door and told me to go out there and don't come back in with the word can't unless we really hit something that really was an obstacle that could not be overcome.
Okay.
In fact, I'll tell you a funny story, if I may. She convinced some Little League coaches they need a blind right fielder. Because right field, nobody almost hits there, and I could play far enough out with the little kids that the ball would hit the ground, hear where it rolled, pick it up, and then someone on the team would shout where to throw it.
Yeah.
Never did get on base from other being hit by the ball all the time and walking. I think only one time I ever got a hit and got on base. Well, one day this became life-changing because it was kind of fun because as the kids got stronger, I had to play further and further out.
Yeah.
And there were three diamonds, and there were times where I was so far out in right field, I was confused by the sound, wondering what game I was in. And then the other team figured out this little thing, so when I had the ball, my team's yelling, throw it here, and the other team's yelling, no, throw it over here.
That's funny. So you were far enough back that you could hear the other teams playing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's funny.
And then what happened one day was I was about 11 years old, and this was monumental for me because this would determine the rest of my life more than probably any other moment in my life. The ball was hit right to me, Phil, and hit me in the glove, and I didn't see it coming. And, of course, I dropped it. Winning run scored. It was some important game.
Yeah.
And not only did the team boo me off the field, even the coach threw a fit, started cussing me out and everything. So I go running home, and I'm crying, and my mom happened to be home that day, and she was baking, and I'll never forget this. She sat me down in a big armchair in the living room, heard the whole story, making sure I wasn't shot or something. You know how parents do when the kids come in, you know. And she just took the corner of her apron, wiped the tears out of my eyes, in one of her seven languages. I don't even know what it was. You know, you can just, your mom could communicate to you no matter what.
Yeah.
And she just pulled back her apron and just squared her shoulders and just said to me, look, here's how it's going to be. The value of your life is not going to be determined by the few things you can't do, but by the many things you can do. And from that moment on, it just changed me. Every time I was confronted with an obstacle, I said, okay, what part of this can I do? If I can't go over it, around it, under it, turn around and go the other way, just don't stop. And that's what I began to do. And then to show you how she was, because she was so stoic, and, you know, in her own way, tough because of the Second World War. She says to me, do you want a glass of milk? And I'm still sulking, and I go, no. You know, no, you know. And she says, good, then get back outside. That was it. Get back in the game, you know. And
yeah.
That's what I took that message to be, and that pretty much changed my life.
Well, those blind children who are mollycoddled by their parents usually don't make it.
I've seen so much of that. I knew some, you know, after the program started in Connecticut, I heard that there were like seven or nine more kids in the next 2 years that followed me into the public school system. Some of them didn't. They stayed in blind schools. I knew of twins that were blind, and one went the road of being coddled, and the other one went on her own. And you could see the difference, you know, with living in institutions versus making a paycheck and having your own place and your own family. And it was,
how did you deal in public school? Because they didn't did they teach you Braille or attempt to or what?
They didn't even attempt to teach me Braille until I was about 11 or 12 years old. And I never really mastered it. I do know a little bit of Braille, like you do. I taught myself level one,
grade one,
the character symbols and the number symbols, so that I can make little Braille labels for CD-ROMs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, CDs and things. I really wouldn't say I read it in any level of proficiency. Mainly on my measuring tape. That's probably where I use it more than anything else.
But so you did the first, say, three or four grades of school by just memorizing.
Totally
memorizing. If you took a test, you made them give it to you orally or?
No, some teachers wouldn't let me take it orally. They'd make me write down the answers.
How would you do that? Get somebody to do it for you?
No. Well, the questions were on the blackboard, and some of the teachers just didn't get what it meant to be blind. And I remember just leaning over to the kid next to me saying, what's the question? And then I would just sit there and write. I was taught how to write. I was taught to read in the sense of I was taught the 26 letters and I could decipher the English code. And in the early days, even with large magnification, you know, like 16, 20x magnification, I had a reading rate of about 22 words a minute because I had to, like, scan with tunnel vision developing. I had to scan the shape of the letter, go, oh, that's an R, and then go look for the next area to scan.
But you could write.
Yeah.
Enough to do the test, and some kid next to you would tell you the question.
Yep, and that was just hours and hours of being punished for not writing neat enough, so I eventually learned how to write neat enough.
And so you stumbled through the first four or five grades.
Yeah, until sixth grade. When the gal who was my first grade teacher became my sixth grade teacher, coincidentally, and that was pretty important because that was the year my parents finally divorced, and that was my grades fell and everything, a lot of nonsense going on at home with the violence and everything else. And she one day contacted the state and said to get one of those bulletin typewriters that write notes for bulletin boards with a very large print, and she, over a six-week period of time on her own, taught me to type after school. And that was a tremendous gift she gave me.
Sure it was.
Because she did it in self-defense because she just couldn't read my handwriting anymore and didn't want to just flunk me because she couldn't read my homework, you know.
So she taught you to type.
She taught me how to type, and that skill stayed with me for many years, obviously. And, of course, I didn't operate my first computer till 1986, so I would have been like 37 years old, 38 years old at the time. I sat down at that keyboard, and it all came back to me.
Yeah, it's like riding a bicycle.
Yeah, exactly. And I was so grateful for her that I spent the last 10 years trying to hunt her down to thank her. And I finally found how to locate her, and I found out she did passed away like 2 months before I finally found her.
Really? That's a shame.
Yeah, because I wanted to thank her.
But you were able to make it through high school.
Yeah.
Did they try to put you in some sort of a class where you could do things with your hands, or did you do the academic route, or how did you make it?
In my town, they divided the high schools in those days by were you going to go to trades, were you going to go to college, were you going to go into business, and I was sent to the college high school, and so it was more use your head more.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, even there. By then, we finally had a special services teacher in the system, which we did not have in grammar school. They didn't get one until pretty much my seventh or eighth grade. Up until then, they were itinerant, and you might have seen somebody from the state maybe once every 6 or 8 weeks showed up, pulled you out of class, and basically wasted your time because they didn't know what to do with me. But in high school, had a teacher that I, special services teacher, her name is Peg, and Peg would come every week. She'd find out, try to help me with my books. But what happened was in high school, I ran into more teachers with attitudes about blindness than I ever thought, I just never expected. It totally blindsided me. By then, we had figured out that the Library of Congress didn't have the books and the editions the teachers would be willing to work with.
Yeah.
Peg worked out a deal with Danbury State Prison, where all the white-collar criminals go. That's where all Nixon's people went.
Yeah.
Well, they could at least read. And we would run real tapes down to Danbury State Prison with a set of the books that we either I would buy or she would buy, because the school wouldn't sometimes give us two sets of books.
Mm-hmm.
So we could rip them apart and hand this chapter to Prisoner 12 and this one to Prisoner 15 and give them a tape recorder. They'd record it. She'd pack all that up and run it to me. Sometimes she'd show up at my house after doing this all through the night, show up at 7 in the morning so I could listen to a tape for an hour, go to school and take a test.
And the prisoners at this federal prison did this?
Yeah, as volunteers.
Man,
and Peg did a lot of it herself, too, when the teachers pulled a fast one on her and just didn't give her enough notice. Some of the teachers wouldn't cooperate, wouldn't give her their lesson plans. And she said, look, I'm a teacher. I'll respect your privacy. I won't tell him what you got coming. Nope, he takes the test on Friday with everyone else, whether he's read it or not. And it was just really interesting. Some of them had an attitude. Now, others went over the other way. They found it an exciting challenge to have a blind kid in their class.
And to help that blind child.
Oh, they certainly did. My algebra, and I had them again for geometry, and I had them again in for trigonometry. What's after that? Whatever's in your fourth year. Calculus. I had them for three out of my 4 years. He was a gentleman named Dave Bartolini. He's passed on now, but he was a great guy. But I had the other kind of teachers. I had one teacher that just kept giving me the test, flunking me, and she didn't care that I never heard the material. And for the whole year, that's what she did. I flunked the first year of English. She just said, you can't do the reading. I don't care. And I just realized that she just basically had it in for me. And that was borne out when I had to take a makeup exam so I could be promoted to sophomore. And it turned out that I can tell this story now because he's gone and it won't hurt him. Dave was the one chosen by the principal to give me the makeup exam. And the way they scored that was that they gave you 100 questions. As soon as you had 70 right, you got a D, and that's how you passed the course. You got a D. You weren't going to do any better than that. So I'm sitting there, first 2 weeks of my sophomore year, and Dave called me up to the front of the room as the class is leaving. And I'm going, uh-oh, because he sounded very serious. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, if I have done something to hurt him and alienate my relationship with him, I might as well quit high school now because he's the only person here pulling for me. And he made me sit down, cleared the room, and he said, you know, I gave you your makeup. I said, yeah. He said, I thought you need to know that you had 72 answers by the time you had your 70 right. And I thanked him for that because I needed to know I wasn't a total failure, that I could cut the mustard. And then he said to me, as you know, Miss So-and-so, your English teacher, has left the school and was transferred to another school. And I said, yes. He goes, well, he said, I'm going to tell you something I think you need to know. And he said, I could lose my job over this, but I think you need to hear this. He said, you know that Mr. Boland, the principal, asked me to clean out her locker in the teacher's lounge. And I said, yeah. He said, all those tapes you never got for those books were in her locker. And he then gave me a big hug, and he started to cry. And he said, son, it's not you. You just need to know it's not you.
All right. Can you hear that?
Yeah, weather? I can.
Let's take a break and let me go. The weather radio has gone nuts. Usually on Wednesday they run this little test, but this is Friday, and I don't know what they're doing. So
you got a tornado coming. Goodbye.
Well, we may have. I'm going to leave the. We'll just take a little break here,
sure,
and be back with more of Blind Like Me in just a second. Our guest. Team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
One of the maddening things about a cell phone is that they charge you so much for the accessories, whether it's a microphone earpiece combinations or whether it's a belt clip or whether it's a case for your phone or even an extra long life battery for your cell phone. Well, if that's the case, you should take a look at www.bargaincell.com. You can look up by phone manufacturer and phone model to see what kind of products they have for your phone. And they have some of the products that are actually made by the manufacturers for the specific phones. They also have aftermarket products. I've ordered from them and been very happy with my results. And you can get the stuff at quite a discount to the original price. I bought a microphone earpiece for my particular phone that normally retails for $20, and I got it for $10, so that's a pretty good deal. It's www.bargaincell.com. I'd give them a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. This is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sight.
All right, we are back with more Blind Like Me. I don't know what that was all about. It just, I don't know if the battery is low in it. Maybe that's the indication, but my heavens, tornado may blow me away any moment. Mike DiZuno is our guest, and Mike has had quite an interesting life. We've got him just about finished with high school, had teachers that loved him, teachers that hated him, but you finished high school at this public school, am I correct?
Yeah, I did. I finished. I graduated in the top third of my class. God only knows why and how, but I did. And then went on to college at the University of Connecticut.
Well, I was going to say, you're obviously a very bright fellow. What did you think you could do with yourself at age 18 when you got out of high school?
Well, by then I had become pretty skilled in a number of trades. I had a part-time job working for the local newspaper. I had always been messing with tools because that was the culture in the town I grew up with, being a shop town. Again, before political correctness, if you were going to be a real man, you knew how to use tools. You had something to fall back on other than a college degree.
Okay.
So then, so I had those skills, and when I went to college, I was very interested in science, very interested in all forms of science, all forms of engineering, because of all the mechanical stuff I had done. So I pursued a study in theoretic nuclear physics and mathematics. Those were my two majors. But it was pretty rocky, to be honest with you, because none of this adaptive technology existed. So how are you going to do things in a physics lab when you can't read the voltmeters and you can't read all the instrumentation? And I went to college with no background in chemistry because of the chemistry teacher in high school, actually literally in 1966, stood in the doorway the first day of school and would not allow me physical entrance into his classroom. He did not want a blind student in the classroom. And the administration, I mean, if that happened today, Phil, that kid would own that town legally in a lawsuit.
Oh, you know, I was going to say a while ago, we complained about government intervention.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't, you couldn't do today what they did to you in high school. That teacher couldn't just keep giving you tests and failing you.
Because we wouldn't totally messed up my college career, because without chemistry, I couldn't take some courses until I had chemistry. And so in physics, some of the courses were 4 consecutive semesters. I had just basically screw around in college for those 2 years and waste time waiting for those classes to come again so I could get some chemistry under my belt. So it set me back 2 years in my college career to the point where eventually I just became too old to be in college. I was on my own at age 19, and pretty much, actually I was pretty much financially emancipated by age 16. I just didn't see where my mother needed to pay for anything. If I was capable of having an odd job or doing chores for neighbors or whatever and making some money, I didn't see why my mother had to pay my dentist bill or my clothes or whatever. So I just, the next progression was just to move out on my own. I began to buy a lot of tools and stuff, got into music like you did, I hear. We have that as a common ground, you know.
Yep.
And I just pretty much just decided that I owned my blindness and I wasn't anybody else's problem except my own. And if folks were going to be kind to me and help me, I appreciated that. And the ones who didn't, well, they weren't legally obligated to.
No, they weren't.
So, you know, and so that was pretty much it. And then went to college, did some fun things in college, joined Army ROTC. And
really?
It took them a while to figure out I was blind. I was almost a second lieutenant before they did. But you got to put it in context. It was the Vietnam War. They were taking anybody.
Yeah.
Do you have a minute for me to share that story, how that happened?
We have plenty of time. That's what we're here for.
Okay. That was kind of fun, and I won't give too many names because I'm not sure that the colonel and the sergeant aren't still collecting their Army pension, so I don't want to hold them up to public ridicule.
Oh, maybe they won't hear it. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, especially since we have men dying over in Iraq, and I don't want to make the military look foolish or anything because this is not what it was about. We were in the student union one day when they announced they were going away from the draft to the lottery system, and my buddies in college were all sitting there going, man, I might as well enlist, at least if you sign up for Army ROTC and go as an officer, they pay your college and this and that, all these other perks. And I'm sitting there going, gee, I ought to enlist. Do they pay for your college and stuff? And, you know, we started, you know, they were teasing me, yeah, you ought to do it and this and that. Well, the joke got out of hand. So when they got up from the table after lunch to go sign up, I just marched across campus with them, and we all went in, sat down. The sergeant put a bunch of papers in front of me and then made the fatal mistake. He left the room while we filled them out. So my 6 buddies filled out the papers for me. And never thinking that
That's
this could
funny.
Ever go on for more than a day or two, this
yep.
joke. It went on for quite a while.
So they filled out the papers for you.
Yeah.
And this sergeant still had no idea that
no.
you were blind.
No, because I had been in the sighted world so long that I could fake it. My mother taught me how to make eye contact with people when I talked to them and stuff, and I was pretty good at faking it. The only things by that point I couldn't do was drive or read.
Well, and you were in a room, and your buddies were there, and so you were going to get maximum help because they were
sure.
in on the...
Sure. They would put my finger on the line and say, here, right here, with you. And my penmanship was still pretty decent.
How far did it go? How far did you get?
Well, I have to be careful what I say here because it went pretty far, Phil. You ever hear of the Pershing Rifles? They're a national drill team. Those are the guys that drill with the Osprey Springfields with the bayonets and throw them at each other. I was the first cadet to qualify for that on its first tryout in 5 years. And that's because when I was a younger kid in the project, there was a former Marine drill sergeant who kind of took some of us kids with no dads under his wings and taught us some stuff. And I never thought that I'd be standing there with a weapon with a bayonet on it, tossing it back and forth with a guy doing the marching manual. And that was an interesting experience. But then again, I had a couple of buddies, and they would just whisper under their breath, you know, track a little more left, you know, you're getting ahead of the squad, you know, and because I had long legs and I tend to walk a little faster than most.
Mm-hmm.
And so they covered for me. And there were a lot of funny stories and things that came out of that. And matter of fact, somebody's talking to me, they want to do a screenplay and actually making a movie. But I will tell you what really came out of it. I had A's in military science, and I was good at taking the tests, and I enjoyed, we hung together as guys, and it was fun. And, you know, we go bowling together, we do things together, the cadets. And, but what came out of it was I got up close to a man's world. And again, I don't mean to sound politically incorrect, but you have to just put this in the context of the time.
Okay.
I'm raised with no father, desperate for a father figure. And when I saw the way Sergeant Hoover, his name was, conducted himself, and the way Colonel Chester conducted himself, they didn't do things because it was easy. They did it because they said they'd do it. They lived by a very strict code of discipline for themselves.
Yeah.
And it rubbed off on me. And it really formed my leadership skills, which served me very well in business, heading up companies and stuff in later life. The buck stops here.
Yeah.
And for blind people at any age, anybody with a disability, you've got to have that attitude about your own life. If the buck doesn't stop with you, who's it supposed to stop with?
Okay, let's get back to this rifle, this bayonet throwing thing.
God.
Again, and you're not getting off that easy.
Okay.
Did you this was a rifle? Did you fire the rifle or did you throw the
was drilling with the rifle. Yes, I've actually fired automatic weapons and stuff.
Yeah.
That was part of the gig, and that's another story. What had happened was, and anybody who knows anything about rifles, if you look at some of those, if you can see, if you can't, somebody's maybe explained it. In those movies, they show the guy sitting around the campfire with the rifles hooked together with what they call the stacking swivel at the top of a rifle. And they link them together, and they can stand them up in a tripod, keep them out of the mud. Well, that stacking swivel jingles. So I knew when he was going to throw the rifle because I could literally hear the jingle. And because they would slap the rifle and it would jingle, and I knew, you know, X number of milliseconds, it was coming to my left hand, and mine needed to be launched out of my right hand and thrown to him. And this is how we did
it. Okay, so he was throwing to you, and you were throwing to him at the same time.
Yeah.
But you had to catch what he threw.
But the guys who were good at this, and I knew this guy was good, they wouldn't have him auditioning, you know, tryouts for the squad.
Yeah.
I knew he'd put that right in the palm of my hand. All I had to do was be ready to snap my thumb on it and close my hand. And I was pretty right about that. He was good, this guy.
But if you had closed your hand... I don't know who this is on the other line. I am doing an interview right now, and I can't answer the other phone line, the 2627 number. So how about you don't call it again, okay? Thank you. Now, I could talk to them, but they couldn't hear me. They could hear me.
Oh.
If you caught it incorrectly, you would have caught the bayonet.
That's what another thing. When they threw it, they threw the rifle vertical, so the bayonet was pointing up.
I got your point.
They threw it in the vertical plane, but if you didn't have your hand ready to receive it, you'd either end up with a busted thumb or four busted knuckles.
Okay, so you were throwing a rifle at this guy, and he was throwing a rifle at you.
Yeah.
How far away was he?
20 feet.
20 feet. So he was facing you straight on.
Yeah, straight on.
Your hearing was really good then. You could hear when he put the rifle, you say he slapped the rifle, made a noise,
What happened first. There's several ways to do what they call the 21-count marching man. And anybody with military experience hearing this will know what I'm talking about. There's the way that they usually do it when marching, not much movement of the rifle, and that's how he started out. He threw it, he threw it at me then, and I dropped it because I didn't even hear it coming.
Oh.
And so what happened, he said, "You're washed out." And I was picking my weapon up because it was off the ground, or his weapon off the ground.
Yeah.
And I said to him, "This is a bunch of blank, blank."
Yeah.
I said, "You know, this is not the man's way to do this." I said, "If you knew what you were doing, you'd do it with a double forward twirl and the backflip, which is a way of twirling it like a baton. That gave the rifle more movement. And to control it, you had to slap it to stop its momentum, which would make that stacking swivel jingle." And he just looked at me, and friends of mine told me the way this played out. He looked at me and said, "You're on," because this guy was not going to be shown up by an upstart, you know. And when he played my game, I could beat him his own game. That's when I qualified.
But
for
at this
triumph.
Time, at this point in time, this poor guy did not know you were blind.
No, my buddies were covering for me again. They did everything they did to, you know, get me in the door, up the stairs, stand in the right place, and everything else. Very subtly, we developed a lot of quiet, subliminal commands, you know, coaching, you know.
Because they were still with you, and they were in on the
joke. They knew what the joke was.
Wait, do you have contact with any of these guys anymore?
Some of them I do. They were in my fraternity later on in college.
You need to find one of them, and we need to do both of you sometime in an interview and get his perspective on what he thought of what you were doing. That's a great story.
Well, it was fun.
It was fun. It's a wonder the sergeant didn't kill you when the jig was up.
Actually, what happened was I was pretty good because, remember, we're there for college, and I had labs because of my physics studies, so a lot of the things I could get out of legitimately because studies came first, okay? And with them, that was their attitude. And so I could miss some of the intermediate physicals, but it came down to the big physical. This is the one where, like, 6 weeks later, you were going to be a second lieutenant in the United States Army.
All right, okay.
And what happened there was it was an eye test. And there was just no way. That was it. I was at the end of the chute, like they do at a rodeo, and I'm coming out into the arena. I'm in front of the eye chart.
This is how it ended.
Yeah. And what he said to me was that, read the chart on the wall, and my response was, what wall? And at first he thought I was kidding, and then they found out, and then at that point, as they say, the jig is up.
What did the guy say to you?
When he went and told the colonel, because the colonel was like a month or two away from retiring on a 30-year career.
Yeah.
Sergeant was probably 6 months away. He'd served in Vietnam 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget, the colonel called me in his office. He's sitting at his desk, sergeant standing at attention behind him, and the colonel says, look, you know, come on. You didn't think you were going to get away with this, you know? And you know, I was pretty flip about it. I said, well, you know, yeah, I thought so. He said, surely you didn't think you were going into the Army and you were going to go over to Vietnam and da-da-da. And I said, no, not really. And he said, you know, we can't allow this to continue. And I said, why not? And that's when he pounded his fist on the desk, because all he could see was being the laughingstock of the Army and watching his 30-year pension go out the window.
I'm sure he was the laughing, you know.
And that was not my intention. And actually, I told him very honestly that I got a lot of good value out of what they taught me, and I thanked him for what they did. And, of course, I was ordered to turn in all my gear, turn in my weapon and everything else.
And get the hell off the base.
We left the college to drill at the Army Reserve place, and this was in his office on campus that this happened. So he didn't tell me to get off the base. But when I actually did very well in all the written work. I had A's in military science and everything else, and I began to take it pretty seriously. And not that I ever expected I was going in the Army, but I just enjoyed the male bonding, and I enjoyed being part of a team where it was all about performance. And as long as I got the job done, that's what I was being praised for, not being praised because I got the job done because I was blind.
And then also the one other benefit from it is it made you or brought you much closer to the sighted persons who were in on the joke with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
they were good buddies. They were good guys. And so what happened was, when I turned in my gear, this was very, very touching. Sergeant Hoover was very stoic. I put all my stuff up on the counter, and he just looked me up and down, and he just said to me, he said, the best cadet I ever had, and I can't have him. And he just grabbed my stuff off the counter, turned about face, and went back to the shelf, because I was very serious. And apparently he saw something in me that I didn't see in myself at that point, some qualities of leadership or something.
But they didn't get angry because you'd put one over on them.
No, they were actually, well, quite the opposite. When I was allowed to attend the final assembly where they announced the new cadet officers for the next semester and all that, and and Colonel Chester, before he wrapped up the proceedings, the exercise there, said, and there's one person I want to recognize. And it was quite a touching moment.
Yeah.
And he said, this individual has more guts than anybody I've ever met in the 30 years I've been in this man's army. He called me front and center, and he handed me his sword. And he said, good luck to your son. May you have a great life.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, we spent a lot of time on that, but I think it was worth it. It's a funny story, but it's also a great story. It just shows what you can do if you've got the nerve to do it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the whole thing, is having the nerve to... I talked to a guy a while ago who's a radio guy, and he's he went to San Antonio, and the guy who was going to interview him didn't know he was blind, and he walked in, he handed a guy the air check, and he said, when do I start? And the guy said, well, you know, can you really do this? He said, well, hell, you hear my air check here? Of course I can do it. You know, when do I start? And he said, that's why I got the job in San Antonio. Anyway, you were out of college. You were on your own. You did not finish a degree plan, correct?
No, I did not. No, I worked to keep my brother in school, to keep his deferment up, to keep him out of the Vietnam War. By then, the war was winding down.
Yeah.
I needed to be on my own and earn a living. And, of course, living 60, 70 miles away from the university and knowing my hometown, and that's where most of my job opportunities would be, because I had my network there. And so it just became hard, the logistics of working back and forth.
Yeah.
So I continued to work at the newspaper and at their sister printing plant. And that's when I began to realize that I loved working with my hands. And during that time is when I began to acquire the tools and stuff and open my own little home improvement company.
So you started a home improvement company. This is basically not building new houses but working on old houses.
Yeah, I did a lot of repair work and stuff, and which I loved doing. It was very challenging. You got to constantly solve new problems every day. But the first problem I had to solve was mobility.
You had to hire a driver, buy a truck, and hire a driver.
Exactly.
And buy the tools.
Find out who could drive. Sometimes there were people working next to me who were not qualified to be in construction, but I needed them for the privilege of going to work. They made more money at the end of the week than I did from the job, just paying them, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, and that's another challenge that blind people have, is the economic disadvantage. I think anybody with a disability or without any kind of training or something going for them is going to be at the bottom end. And even though I became quite a proficient tradesman, I was still working for a third to half prevailing wages for most of my, the beginning of my career, at least for 10 years, because people had the attitude that, hey, he's blind. He should be grateful we even hired him.
Yeah. But you had no training in this field. This is something you just figured out.
Yeah.
In other words, each problem, when you went to someone's house, you figured out how to do what they needed done.
Well, I had a lot of experience prior to that. It's just growing up in the environment I grew up in. My dad, before he left us and during the split up there, had his own television store back in the days when if you were in a TV store, you did everything. I mean, you had to be an electrician, you had to run the cable for the jukeboxes, you had to put up the antennas, make the steel towers. I mean, I was doing that work at 8, 9 years old, climbing up on church steeples with my dad.
Okay.
And it was, you know, I had to cut the angle iron, drill the holes, because he was tired of doing that. So he'd say, look, here's what I need. You know, make me an antenna base for this antenna. And I was doing that as a kid. And tools were second nature. Again, my parents, I was in a culture where everybody had some kind of skill or trade. This was a blue-collar town. And, you know, there were tool makers and bricklayers and electricians and millwrights and all these kind of people. And since I was one of those pesky little kids that would just ask why, all the questions all day, you know, they began to just they went on mentoring mode. These guys would tell me anything. I'd spend days just asking them questions, and because of it, I learned a lot, even after my father was gone, because they had a willing student. They were teachers.
But you were in a totally different thing now. Now you were in home remodeling, and so a lady might want a wall ripped out. How did you just figured out how to do those things? Or?
The jobs ramped up. They started out just repairing railing.
Okay.
And you know, and they started out, you know, can you build a set of stairs outside on my porch? Can you do this? And little by little, and of course, the more I did, the more I grew.
So you just...
I already had the skills of using the tools from my childhood.
Yeah.
And it was just, and then in my later teens, you know, in high school, you know, I, you know, owned a radial arm saw, and you go and, you know, you buy the hammers and you buy the, you know, I was doing car mechanic work. Because of the band, that was another thing, too. Every band is hand to mouth. Our old truck kept breaking down, so... You know, I learned how to fix transmissions because no one else had the skill in their hands to do what I did. You know, I could work in the most adverse conditions. I could work in the dark, go under the truck, and pull the transmission because I don't need light.
That's right.
you know, and I know you've done a lot, too, and I've been listening to some
and
of your...
When the guy asked you to build a set of stairs, you went and looked at a set of stairs and said, oh, well, I'll do
exactly.
build it like that.
Exactly. You're blind, huh?
that's how you figure out how to build a set of stairs.
Sure,
you go look at a set.
See what other people do and then figure out what part of it can you do and what part of it you're going to have to do the blind way and come up with a new way to do.
That's how you learn to do things. You go look at what somebody else did, and then you do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you did this, you rode this train, but you got quite successful at this, I think, didn't you?
Yeah.
You ended up with a company tell us about it. Or just tell us about your company.
Well, what happened was I realized right away no one was going to give a blind guy much opportunity, so I realized in 1973 I had to be on my own. So I quit my other jobs, and I just pretty much went on my own, figuring I could starve on my own without someone else's help. I was right about that for the next 7-8 years. I built the company. And I built it on just working really hard and just delivering quality. And pretty soon I built a reputation that there was this blind guy in town that could do just about anything. And so when I built the company, I just made sure that, like, everybody was happy. I mean, I built it on customer service.
Yeah.
And I built it on being a minimal inconvenience for them. And what I mean is, you know, they didn't have to sit there and watch out for me and stuff. And, you know, I still had to put up with some prejudice from some people. I had one helper one day. We were on one job, and my helper every morning would find notes from the homeowner directed to him. Now, he's my helper, and they're asking him questions about my qualification. And that was pretty demeaning. But you know what? It was about the successful conclusion of the job. Instead of getting an attitude that, you know, I'm being discriminated against or hurt, I was just glad to have the work. And because, you know, the more work, I could buy more tools, I could practice with them, I could do more
things.
Well,
besides that, you needed to eat.
Yeah. Well, that's another part of it, too, because to maintain my lifestyle, I needed to have more income than the average person, disposable income.
Yeah.
Not because I lived extravagantly. I lived in a modest little apartment, and the lady let me build a shed to store my tools in and park my trucks. And by then, I had two trucks in case one was for spare parts. But what I was more excited about was it gave me the privilege of being independent. I solved the mobility issue. I could afford to pay people to read my mail. I could afford to pay people to balance my checkbook. I could afford to pay people to go get groceries for me.
Okay.
I could afford to pay people to drive me if I wanted to go bowling in the middle of the afternoon. And that to me was such a tremendous privilege that I'd work 80 hours a week to maintain that lifestyle. I don't
okay.
care.
So you were running two trucks, or you just had an extra truck? Or
no, I had an extra truck for parts.
Okay.
Because, I was living pretty hand-to-mouth, and it was easier to rip the muffler system off of one, put it on the other, or swap the engine heads or whatever, cylinder heads, and, you know.
But this guy was driving to your house every morning, your helper, and then you and he would get in the truck and you'd go to the job and do whatever needed to be done.
And in the beginning, some of the drivers weren't even driving to my house. These were people who had a license, but they were down and out people living in the projects, and they had a valid driver's license, and that made them good to me. And I would, you know, give them a little part-time work because, you know.
Yeah.
And I couldn't afford to hire anybody qualified or competent full-time. That would have meant, you know, committing to a salary annually that was bigger than what I was living on, you know.
Yeah.
But then eventually, it took some steam. I started doing some sweat equity inner city apartments. There were some things in the change in the economy when IBM built their new world headquarters about 13, 14 miles away from where I grew up. A lot of work then. They didn't care what you were. Just get the work done. And the other thing, too, that was I just want to share was pretty funny. Sometimes I just got tired of being the boss, and I would think every so often to go to work for someone else. And, of course, they wouldn't hire me.
No.
And that just used to really upset me. So on a couple of occasions, I actually then went and started a company that did exactly what they did, competed against them, took work away from them, and when I had more than I could handle, I used to hire them back as subcontractors.
Just to prove to them, and yourself.
Look what you lost. And
yeah.
And I was pretty successful at that. And then in the now, it wasn't all successful all the time. There were ups and downs.
Sure.
And in the mid '80s, things things changed, and it all came down like a house of cards. I had several companies and everything else, and I learned a hard business lesson. I spent so much time focusing on getting good at my trade, I didn't know how to be a businessman. And I got taken out for $500,000 owed to me by two guys, and that just collapsed the companies overnight, everything I had built for 20 years.
In other words, the vendors that you did to work for went bankrupt and couldn't pay you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That happens.
And, of course, that just killed everything.
That happens to so many small businesses.
Yeah. And of course, back then there was none of this adaptive technology. I had to trust. Everything was in my head. There was no such thing as bookkeeping. You know, everything was in my head as far as who owed me what and everything else. There weren't, a lot of stuff was done on a handshake, no formal contract, because that's paperwork. And I didn't know how to do paperwork as a blind person.
And so they took you down.
Yeah, they took me down.
Bankruptcy?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, only after trying to beat it, owed $3.8 million, paid every penny of it back over 7 years, except about $250,000. But by the end of the 7 years, got caught up in the gears of the legal system, and actually paid double that back, and still owed twice what I owed because the lawyers take most of it at that point.
Yeah.
So eventually, I did file a Chapter 7, and I came down in 1992 to be within 10 days of a foreclosure being put in the street. Didn't have anything left, no credit, no nothing. And had a lady that
this is in 92
vitamins.
This is in 92.
This is in 92.
So you're 43, 4 years old.
Yeah, I'm within 10 days. What had happened was in the interim, a girl that I was engaged to died. Met another gal. We got married, and a year and a half after we were married, she became disabled. That ended her medical career. And, of course, I was pretty good by then at the disability thing. You know, I knew how to pick myself up one more time and start over, but she didn't. And she was pretty devastated because she had just, one of those people, went to work, got her paycheck, lived responsibly and everything.
Uh-huh.
And here we're sitting there, $692,000 in debt from medical bills, Social Security denying her claim, saying she was too educated to be disabled, even though she couldn't stand up out of bed, take more than one or two steps.
I didn't know that was. Today we'd fight that. We wouldn't let them do that.
No, I know. But, you know, it took 4.5 years in court for Social Security to pay one dime of the bills, and it was finally because some gal at the insurance company that was paying the short-term transition insurance felt sorry and talked to her boss, and the insurance company actually paid for the lawyer so we could fight Social Security.
And Social Security finally came through with the
big
check.
Social Security finally came through, but by then, you know, 4.5 years after we needed it, so we came down to within 10 days of being put in the street. And actually, I'll never forget the day. It was 27th of April, 92. I wake up that morning. I got shut-off notices for my lights and telephone. I got nothing left. I got a blind check from the government coming in. That's all I've got to show for 22 years of working as a carpenter and
okay.
in the trades. That was less than $500 a month. Got $21 less in the checking account. Every credit card is maxed. Chrysler calls are coming to repossess the car in 3 days. Bunny goes in the kitchen to make some lunch, and I go in the kitchen to help her, and I find out that we're out of food. There's nothing left in the house.
Nothing to eat.
Nothing to eat. So my grand plan to survive was to go in the living room. We had an old Victorian and a lot of couches in there. And when things were good, we used to party, and you know our friends would come over and they'd drop change. So we actually went through the couches for change, got 3.25, figuring we could go to McDonald's for a picnic. Optimism, right? A picnic. Use the car one last time, and just at least get through lunch.
Yeah.
And before I could finish checking the last couch, there's a knock at the door. I opened the door, and I felt this something hit me in the stomach, and I reached down. There's this big, huge roll of papers, and I asked what this was, and that was the county sheriff, and he told me those were the foreclosure papers. We had 10 days to get out of the house.
He'd serve papers on you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then again, you know, okay, pretty close to the edge, and then something good happened.
All right, what did you do?
A gal that I was buying vitamin supplements from called me about 5 o'clock that night. Bunny and I are sitting on the edge of the bed wondering what the heck we're going to do for supper. Meanwhile, I had heated the house all winter by burning things. We didn't have money for fuel oil.
Yeah.
We sold the piano, actually, so we could buy one tank of oil because Bunny needed hot baths for her lake, so we just used it for heating hot water, the furnace. We didn't use it to heat the house.
Okay.
And, of course, it was the coldest winter we had in 108 years in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
you know. And so it was kind of interesting. So she calls me and just asked me, said, you wouldn't want to sell vitamins with me part-time, would you? And Bunny and I just wanted to know, like, well,
when do we start?
Yeah, when do we start? Can we make $75 fast? Because Bunny needed one of her prescriptions filled.
Yeah.
We needed food. I knew if I could go down to the light company and at least give them $25 to keep my lights turned on until my blind check came in.
Yeah.
Well, little did I know that that was going to turn out to be one of those, another one of those great moments, because she had just, this gal who called us had just been dumped by a guy that she was going to get married to. She had no life. And she then basically just about moved in with Bunny and I, and we formed an extended family, so she was there to read to me, and I became very good in that industry, and within 2 years, I was able to build that to a six-figure income.
And you sold vitamins how? On the phone, in person?
On the phone, all over the phone. There was no internet,
and
I didn't have money for advertising, so I created a marketing strategy called the Grand Opening, where you know, you don't ask anybody to buy. You just ask them to get the word out that you're there. And matter of fact, that became, that grand opening has been copyrighted since. And if you go on the internet, you'll probably find about, last count somebody told me, were 87 websites, because I train this for other companies. And you'll find me doing the grand opening training for all these different companies online, because it's a way that you can just start over with no money and just get your life back under control.
Which is what you did.
Yeah. So I basically then from there, Phil, was blessed, because with that experience under my belt, people began to call me going, well, you've obviously figured out this disabled thing. You've obviously figured out something else that non-disabled people need to know. And I said, well, what's that? I said, how to build a legitimate home-based business, because you see those ads all the time on the internet and on TV and everything, you know, work from home. And I had done
yeah.
it. And it solved my issues with mobility and everything, because I didn't have to. I could do it over the phone. And so then I spent the next 10-12 years teaching that. And
that's what you do now, is motivational speaking and things
yeah,
of that nature?
Yeah, and I'm pursuing a media career, because
uh-huh.
I would like to do coaching. Because one of the things I found along the way, when I look back at my own life, and you can relate to this, being blind, you're always going to be up against having the time to do more than you could do on your own. The adaptive technology is great. But, you know, and there's ways to work around writing checks and reading your mail and doing all that, but this stuff is just so time-consuming that it's easier to have the money to pay someone to do it.
Sure.
And I began to organize my life and my needs like a corporation, because when I looked at corporations, Donald Trump doesn't drive himself around. Got a limousine. They show up because his time is so valuable. He could be in the back seat on the phone closing another $1 billion deal. And I began to realize that that was true for me too. And I began to realize that money is muscles in our society. And so now what I've been doing is doing a lot of training on economic empowerment for people whose society feels that are at a disadvantage, you know, be they a minority, you know, a racial minority or a religious minority or you know, a disabled person.
Mm-hmm.
It all comes down to the same. You drive the engine here in this society. You live in a capitalistic society, and money drives this society, and you need to play the money game. And it's not about being materialistic, because I still live a very modest lifestyle, but it's just, I just found it's just a lot easier to write a check and pay somebody to do something for you, because then that gives you the right to call them up and say, I need you to do more for me. I found that that took less time than it did to beg favors all the time from family and friends.
So you are what you're wanting to do now is be able to get your message to many, many people
mm-hmm.
through medium.
Yeah.
Through media.
Yeah.
And that is one of the things that you're pursuing now. You say you're 57?
Yes, sir.
But the vitamin sales got you back on your feet.
Yes. I was very successful. I earned just a little short of $2 million in the 12 years I was with that company.